You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 11th of May 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. As it's Thursday, that means we have geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org with us today. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Have you ever noticed that Stanley isn't as active in trying to disrupt these programs as he was?
I think
he's getting older. I think he's given up.
Is that what it is? It's old age, is it? Well, it probably won't be long until you get another addition to your collection of cats. Have you got one cat now? Two cats? Three cats? Dogs? Well, how much have you got there, Matt?
Four cats and two dogs.
Well, I guess we're very lucky that we don't get that many interruptions, to be honest. They must all be very well behaved, or at least over the last few weeks anyway. Well, today we're going to be talking about Ukraine and the United States corporations cashing in on Ukraine's oil and gas. And we're going to be taking our notes from globalresearch.ca, and the author is Ben Norton. As the war in Ukraine drags on, the government is selling off state assets in a big privatization spree. US fossil fuel corporations like ExxonMobil, Chevron and Halliburton are participating in discussions to take over the Eastern European nation's oil and gas industry as Kiev pushes to increase production to replace Russian energy exports. This comes soon after Ukraine's Western-backed leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, sent a friendly video message to a US corporate lobby group thanking companies like BlackRock, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs and Starlink, and promising big business for others. In September, Zelensky also symbolically opened the New York Stock Exchange, announcing that his country is open for business, offering more than $400 billion in public-private partnerships, privatization and private ventures for US companies. The Ukrainian government has used the war as an excuse to ram through some of the most aggressive anti-worker laws on earth. The director of the Kiev-based workers' rights NGO, Labour Initiatives, warned of a, quote, full-scale attack on Ukraine's labour rights, close quote, writing in a German government-funded journal that the war cannot be used to justify stripping workers of their rights. So there is two issues here. There is this removal of Ukraine's labour rights, and there is also the selling off of the oil and gas. Now, correct me, but isn't Russia's gas nationalized, Matt? So what you actually have here is Ukraine's gas and oil is being sold off privately, while in Russia, it's nationally owned. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah, it's something like a public-private partnership. But in Ukraine, Naftogaz has at least claimed to have taken over, which is that is a state company. Taken over the gas industry, which is, I don't think they have that capacity, but that's what they're claiming. And yet the fact that it's state owned doesn't mean much because of who actually runs the state. Of course, Ukraine doesn't have much oil, but it does have natural gas fields. They're not enormous. Talk about that in a minute. In fact, the regime even tried to say that was the purpose of the invasion. But understand that these talking to BlackRock and JP Morgan, these are extremely unpopular measures. All of this has been imposed by the IMF, although the IMF has been pushing for this ever since Maidan 2014, and one of the reasons that revolution took place, isolated in Kiev though it was. No one supports this government. Unless you directly work for it, no one is supporting it. I mean, poverty is now over 80%. You have prices having gone up in some cases 500-600%, and $5 a day is the average wage. There is no more bankruptcy. There are no labor contracts anymore. There's no overtime anymore. But as harsh as all of these are, it's not just the war. The war gave the excuse, but the IMF and the U.S. and the so-called, you know, Ukrainian government, which I've always said is a colonial administration, have been pushing for this for a very long time. So the war is, and then the other issue is so much of this stuff, the Constitutional Court in Ukraine has struck down. And since he's been installed, Zelensky's tried to sack these justices. And once the war started, he was able to do it. We talked about this briefly before. We talked about the labor stuff. We talked about the land and the GMOs, everything going to Western corporations. The Constitutional Court over and over again struck this stuff down. But, you know, they just ignore it. And now once the war started, like half of the Constitutional Court had to flee to Paris. And this is perfectly consistent with the rules-based international order.
Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, we were told that the Maidan coup was all about Ukraine joining the EU. But according to this, it's about them joining BlackRock, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Starlink, and all the rest. And Halliburton, it appears. In an attempt to bring an end to this war, China has taken the lead in advocating peace talks. Brazil's President Lula da Silva has backed Beijing's efforts. The West, on the other hand, has vociferously opposed all attempts at diplomatic negotiations and instead pushed to escalate the NATO proxy war on Russia, sending fighter jets and tanks to Kiev. Ukrainian officials, meanwhile, are treating their country as a for-profit company, frequently travelling to the United States in search of lucrative business opportunities. The CEO of Ukraine's state-owned energy company, Naftogaz, Oleksiy Chernyshov, flew to Washington, D.C. this April to meet with U.S. political and corporate officials. The Financial Times reported that Chernyshov sat down with representatives from ExxonMobil and Halliburton following a similar meeting with Chevron in January. The negotiations with big U.S. fossil fuel players are part of a strategic push to increase natural gas production that Ukrainian officials believe could help replace Russian supply to Europe in the years ahead, the newspaper wrote. Halliburton is notorious for its involvement in corruption schemes involving fat government contracts. In 2017, it was fined $29.2 million by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act with highly profitable oilfield services contracts in Angola. Halliburton is also the world's biggest provider of fracking services, or hydraulic fracturing, a controversial form of gas extraction that is so environmentally destructive it was banned in the United Kingdom. Responding to the Financial Times report, economist Yanis Varoufakis, who previously served as Greece's Minister of Finance, tweeted, "And there you have it, Exxon, Halliburton and Chevron, after Iraq, are now taking over the Ukrainian oil and gas fields, planning to introduce large-scale fracking, a clear and present threat to poison Ukraine's agriculture." Chernyshov, the CEO of Ukraine's state energy company Naftogaz, told the newspaper, "We want them, Halliburton, to expand their presence dramatically. We want them there seriously. Boots on the ground. We will welcome them," he added. "We can do joint production on gas together. PSA agreement, production sharing agreement. They can have a license and produce by themselves, and we will welcome it." In November, the president of Halliburton in the Eastern Hemisphere, Joe Rainey, travelled to Ukraine to meet with Chernyshov. Naftogaz published a press release on its website boasting that it is strengthening its strategic cooperation with America's Halliburton, one of the world's largest oilfield services providers, to unlock the new potential of Ukraine's fields. "Your support and visit to Kiev is a powerful signal for the entire market and the world," Chernyshov said. "I am grateful to the US government, the American people, and you personally for your comprehensive support of Ukraine. We really appreciate it. Our cooperation is extremely important, and we are doing our best to improve and expand it." Well, that's all very well and good, but didn't Ukraine owe lots and lots of money, like billions, to Russia for oil and gas that they hadn't actually paid for? And if they owed all this money to Russia, for oil and gas, how come they're now suddenly able to provide their own? Am I correct in thinking that, Matt, that when they had this coup, they owed a huge debt to Russia for the gas that they were having for keeping themselves warm?
Yes, and I've written about this extensively, you know, years ago. The Western banks are aware that any of these loans and grants, which Ukraine is now completely dependent on, are never going to be paid back. They're not going to anything worthwhile. And Ukraine continually plays. You know, it was appealing to the West years ago, so they didn't have to pay this enormous debt to Russia. And Russia was willing to work with them, even discounting it and lowering prices below market rate. They were willing to do all of this prior to 2014. Now that's gone. The revolution made sure that that happened. So they appealed to the West, saying, "Well, Russians are uncivilized. If you want us to fight Washington's fight, then you'll go to bat for us here." And of course, they didn't pay a dime, nor did they have the capacity to pay a dime. I think a lot of people now have probably forgotten about Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root and these companies. They're always in trouble. They're always paying fines. The Angola case was particularly bad. I read the press release on that. No bid contracts and inflating prices, especially with, you know, in Angola has a state oil corporation too. And it's the exact same kind of relationship. We also spoke of prior to 2014, the biggest error of Yanukovych's career was when he allowed BP and Shell domineering, political and police rights over huge areas of Ukraine for the sake of this shale development. I mean, shale oil is a last-ditch effort to try to suck any kind of petroleum product out of the earth. It's extremely painstaking. It's very expensive. You have to really – and of course, given the fact that gas prices, petroleum prices have gone up about 700% just recently – in Ukraine, I guess there is some profit to be made, except no one could really afford to buy it. And this was one of the reasons that there was a big problem with him, as far as the ordinary citizen is concerned. They had full, you know, fracking takes so much water. This is why it's so destructive. And they were given full police rights over huge areas of Ukraine. And on top of that, full and primary preferential rights to the entire water supply of Ukraine. And, you know, of course, we predicted that that's going to be reinstalled now. And this is something else that the courts have struck down, and the war gave the opportunity to do it anyway. You know, the sale of land, or natural resources. Ukraine doesn't have a functional economy. I mean, most of its budget comes from selling bonds to foreigners and just printing and printing money. Tax revenues are almost nothing, although their actual direct tax revenues are zero. Oligarchs don't pay taxes. The IMF, on the one hand, wants all social services cut. There aren't really any social services anymore. The economy for the average person is got to be underground. No one trusts the currency. And these kind of deals where these companies are able to buy parts of Ukraine and run it as private property. That's all they have left. The asset stripping is the only real functional aspect of the economy, and it's completely destructive. This is what privatization is. I don't care how high you push interest rates, and they keep going up there. I don't care how high you push them. That's never going to make. It doesn't matter. It could be 200%. That's not going to bring anybody to actually invest in the country unless they have full police power. You know, the Constitution, in other words, it's suspended in these areas, and they can run it like a mini state, and which is exactly what's going on. That's probably, and even there, you know, it's iffy. And now, of course, the assumption is east and west so that Ukraine obviously can't possibly win this. They have no resources left. The casualties are extraordinarily high on Ukrainian side, and so. They're banking on the war ending relatively soon, but keeping it going long enough so all of this stuff could be rammed through, because war has always been the excuse for governments to do things like this. And the fact that here you have a Greek finance minister who knows how the IMF and the debt collection services work firsthand, seeing the same thing happen to his country, essentially destroying it. He knows exactly what he's talking about. This is what privatization means. I read the other day that about 35% of all state purchasing is from foreigners, even though there's cheaper Ukrainian variations of whatever it is they're buying. That goes for military purchases and everything else. In other words, no one trusts the Ukrainian economy, not even the state. There's simply no more money. So the only thing they can do then is, in a literal sense, not metaphorically, literally sell the country to whatever companies want to do it. That's the only way they can get anyone to come in.
Well, of course, Halliburton is also very well known for corruption. Halliburton was a household name in the United States in the 2000s and was practically synonymous with corruption. Vice President Dick Cheney, who served under former President George W. Bush, had worked for years as chairman and CEO of Halliburton. Cheney, a hardline neoconservative, was a key architect of the illegal US invasion of Iraq in 2003. That same year, Halliburton was given what NPR described as a sweetheart deal in Iraq. NPR wrote, "Oil services company Halliburton has come under intense scrutiny over its multi-billion dollar contracts with the US military in Iraq. Congressional critics want to know if the company is engaging in gold-plating contracts, inflating costs, and pocketing the difference. Other critics charge that Halliburton has seemingly become another branch of the US military, while the company's former chief executive officer, Dick Cheney, is now the vice president. In the first of a three-part series looking at the complex relationship between the defense contractor and the federal government, NPR's John Burnett examines the scope of contracts in Iraq held by Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root, better known as KBR. America's war on terrorism has created a windfall for KBR. Since September 11, 2001, the company has constructed base camps at more than 60 locations throughout the Middle East and South Asia. Under its deal with the Pentagon, known as a log cap contract, KBR is the go-to company to provide troops in Iraq with everything from portable toilets to internet cafes. A decade later, the International Business Times reported that Halliburton subsidiary KBR had received more Iraq-related contracts than any other private firm in the 10 years of the war. The media outlet reported, "The company KBR was given $39.5 billion in Iraq-related contracts over the past decade, with many of the deals given without any bidding from competing firms, such as a $568 million contract renewal in 2010 to provide housing, meals, water, and bathroom services to soldiers, a deal that led to a Justice Department lawsuit over alleged kickbacks." And of course, what the government would say, they would say, well, of course, it's much easier if we just deal with one company that provides all of this. But then who is going to make certain that that company isn't inflating prices if they're not actually competing against any other company? But that would be the excuse that they give, is that it's so much easier to have one person that is just responsible for doing all of this. Over here in Britain, we have a company called Serco that provides everything for from prison cells to asylum seekers to school meals. They're just responsible for everything. And you get the same accusation that Serco are inflating the prices of these contracts because they're not actually competing against anybody else. But then the government, again, they will say, well, it's much easier to just have one person responsible for this. So it's a bit of a catch-22. What do you make of this KBR here, Matt? And what would you say to the government if they said, well, it's much easier if we're just dealing with one company to provide all of these needs?
Well, Ukraine doesn't have the money to pay any price, let alone an inflated price. The very fact that after the Bush presidency, Cheney just went right back to his vice presidential position with the company means that some of these firms or firms like that assume that really they're untouchable. And that fine, which was $27 million from years ago, is a fraction of their profit. And the profit really, you know, we talked about the charging of rent, and this is a rent. Because of their power, because of their connection with the federal government, they can have no bid contracts. So that dollar amount between what the market would actually want and their position of monopoly, that inflated price, that's a rent. It comes exclusively because essentially it's a protected firm. And I'm willing to bet that that fine came with concessions from the Justice Department, not just from Halliburton, because it really didn't hurt them, especially. And all it does is give them the incentive to continue to overcharge. In the Ukrainian case, you don't have any functional law. We talked about that not just now, but several times. Since Ukraine doesn't have any money, and most of its industry is in the East anyway, and hence out of its control, and we've also talked about this, the endless deindustrialization. Ukraine is dependent on foreign aid, loans, grants, and huge amounts from the American and American taxpayer. That's all they have. So they're just going to be paid with the money from that foreign aid. So it's just a feedback loop. Given that this is all the same people, private banks and groups like Halliburton, and they all know each other, this is in and of itself, it's a kickback. The entire operation is. The only other thing, of course, other than aid money that they have to use is chunks of land. They keep talking about privatization now, like for 30 years. And I don't know what's left to privatize. But it isn't as if outside of this shale sector, a Western company could go in and run it. They're just going to strip it. Everything is short term. And this is why the bank just prints money and prints money and prints money. Technically it's a state institution, the National Bank of Ukraine. When it's a colonial entity, that doesn't make any difference. The IMF decides who sits on the central bank. In fact, the former president this year of the bank, Cyril Shevchenko, disagreed with this kind of policy, just printing money. And the IMF told the Ukrainian government to get rid of him. And they did. They opened up all kinds of silly corruption charges, and he fled the country. I think – I forget where he is now. But this is normal. This is what happens here. This is almost a brand new hybrid form of rule that not just private public, but foreign private public. When you have no money, you have really no prospects. The only thing you have left is asset stripping. But now there's no more assets to strip. So this has been completely deindustrialized. And I should note, you mentioned asylum seekers. I think it's something like 70% of the UK's farm worker visas went to Ukrainians. This war has been a boon for the West for a whole bunch of other reasons, but also because places like Poland and the UK are getting very motivated, well-educated workers who are paid a fraction of what a native worker would make. And again, they want to keep the war going long enough to take advantage of this, but not too long, such that they can't steal whatever is left of the country, including the very country itself. So in a state of a losing war, rather than the state taking over the economy, in fact, not only are they privatizing it, but they're selling it off to foreigners since no one else has any money. And, the oligarchs are spending it in the West. They keep a lot of their money in the West and not in Ukrainian hryvnia. And it was precisely this that caused the revolution in the east of the country after the Maidan protests. And that battle continued, and just a new stage of it was initiated in February of 22 with the invasion. Essentially, it's all one conflict. That's why people like myself, Alexander Dugin, see this as a war between a nationalist and state guided economic policy versus this oligarchic so-called free market postmodern capitalist on the other. And that's exactly what's happening here. And as this goes on, the Ukrainian government gets less and less popular to the point now where it just doesn't register. So all of this is forced by foreign powers out of a desperate country that foreign powers control anyway. And the only loser, of course, is the average person.
Well, it looks like Ukraine is eyeing the natural gas deposits that are actually off Crimea. The Financial Times reported that the Ukrainian government specifically hopes to drill for offshore natural gas in the Black Sea, off Crimea. Kiev is unable to access that gas, however. Crimea was annexed by Russia in 2014, following a referendum with 83% turnout in which 97% of participants said they wanted to join the Russian Federation. Western governments cast doubt on the vote, but polling by mainstream US firm Pew Research found that 91% of Crimeans said the referendum was free and fair, and 88% wanted Ukraine to recognise the results. Despite Crimeans' overwhelming support for integration with Russia, Ukraine and its NATO sponsors have insisted that they will retake the region, not only because of its valuable offshore gas reserves, but also due to its deep geostrategic importance for Russia. Russia only has one warm water naval base, the Sevastopol base in Crimea. This is the main base used by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, and without it, the sea would effectively become controlled by NATO. For Moscow, this is genuinely a security concern, not one motivated by ulterior economic interests. Even the US military-backed think tank the RAND Corporation conceded this, publishing a report in April 2022 titled "Russia Does Not Seem to Be After Ukraine's Gas Reserves." RAND wrote, "Ukraine does indeed control Europe's second largest known reserves of natural gas, almost 80% of which are located east of the Dnipro River. However, these reserves amount to less than 3% of Russia's total natural gas reserves. And although Ukraine theoretically might have considerable shale gas reserves, they remain largely unproven, and Russia currently has no experience or technology for shale gas production." During his trip to Washington this April, Naftogaz CEO Chernyshov not only met with corporate executives, he also sat down with senior government officials, like former US Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt. Pyatt represented Washington in Kiev during a violent US-backed coup in 2014, which overthrew Ukraine's democratically elected, geopolitically neutral government and installed a pro-Western regime. A notorious leaked phone call from top State Department official Victoria Nuland showed US officials deciding who would run the Ukrainian government after the coup. Joining Nuland on the call was none other than Pyatt. Today, Pyatt serves as US Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Resources, and he also coordinates cooperation between the G7 and Ukraine. In a press release on Chernyshov's meeting with Pyatt, Naftogaz wrote with pride that it is working to attract American companies, their technologies, expertise, and investments to increase production in Ukraine. We discussed a number of issues, from Ukraine's new role in Europe's energy security system to the implementation of corporate governance reform, Chernyshov said. Well, I would look at that and I would say, well, you know, Russia wants Crimea. They've got a naval base there. That's the only place they can have a naval base. They can't actually have a navy if they haven't got that base there. So it is important to them. And Ukraine is wanting the gas there, which Russia is not interested in because it only represents 3% of the gas that they have. And they don't have this shale gas technology. Wouldn't a solution to all this be to say, well, Ukraine, you can have that gas and that oil there, which will help to fund Ukraine, and we'll have our naval base here in Crimea? Why would they not be able to do that, Matt? Would there be an issue with the oil companies being there right by the naval base? Why don't they come to that kind of an agreement, do you think?
Well, partially because, you know, the U.S. won't let them. Now, the consensus seems to be that obviously whatever's left of the Ukrainian military could never and would never retake Crimea, despite that being a propaganda point for a while. Because Russia, so can you imagine, you know, your economy has shot through the roof since that referendum, because now you're using the ruble, you get a lot of Chinese investment, Russian investment, all the assets go up in value. Can you imagine returning to Ukraine now? It would be immediate poverty, mass poverty, and all the assets that they've been building up would be stripped immediately. That's what's at stake here. And any kind of negotiated settlement, I guarantee you Russia would have no particular difficulty with an arrangement like that, given how liberal Russia has been with Ukraine for energy prices for years and years and years. But of course, it's the West's own meddling and the IMF's restructuring of the economy. to the point where it's a revolution in 2014. In other words, every aspect of life has been upended and aimed at corporate profit rather than the state or the nation or anything like that, and all that money being taken abroad. As we say, it's the regime wants to keep the war going long enough to be able to extract what they can extract. But Crimea, the Crimeans themselves would take up arms, knowing full well what would happen to them there. I mean, Ukraine's ports are closed, but Crimea's aren't. And their ports have been built or refurbished, I should say, by Chinese firms. Everything is looking up for them. So that the U.S., be given sanctions, given their irrational hatred of Russia, that it would include oil firms as well as anybody else, would never permit any concessions here. Because, as you said, the Russian oil has a strong state presence. Because really going back to years and years ago, the attempted sale of it to ExxonMobil. So then the state had to step in and arrest all of those involved in that. This is, 20 years ago. And because it's connected to the Russian state, the U.S. or the West can have no connection with it. But that's the very point. This Piat, we spoke about him a while ago concerning the Maidan coup. He has been one of the conduits where this cash, military stuff, has been sent to Ukraine over the years. And the very fact that you're talking about shale oil, which, by the way, is hypothetical. So I'm not sure really what the game of Halliburton is, if they're not even 100% sure where this is. The point is that you have Halliburton doing this, and yet Piat is the go-between who happens to be the Secretary of State for Energy Resources. I guarantee I could have told you his role without actually knowing his role, given the fact that he suddenly become very prominent. The guy's a complete idiot, but he does have the opinion that whatever Ukrainian government does, even slightly outside of American dictate, can easily be ignored. Calling for the resignation of the mayor of Kiev and all this stuff. He just has this arrogant dismissiveness about him where the only thing that matters is American energy firms. So he's promoting an idea and helping to fund this Halliburton move. And I'm sure other oil companies are involved, as we already mentioned, like ExxonMobil, to explore for shale, not necessarily immediately start fracking, but taking over huge parts of the country and then now digging all over the place. The Supreme Court of Ukraine keeps knocking it down and knocking it down and knocking it down, and it just doesn't matter. The Defense Council of Ukraine, which is American-dominated, that runs the country, and all of this has one core nucleus, a tiny group of people, and Piat at the center of it. I've mentioned that the Ukrainian government is run through the American embassy. That would mean that Piat is essentially a colonial director or a colonial administrator of Ukraine. And it was the same thing with Kosovo. So this is a revolutionary and completely experimental form of economy that I don't think has really ever been tried before. And you can't even talk about a state sector and a private sector, since the two of them are so tightly related. The only difference is that anything that the state owns, including the bank itself, although I don't think anyone wants to buy it, it should be immediately privatized and that money going to pay debt. That's what the Maidan coup was in the first place. Ukraine was drowning in debt in 2014 and 2004, which was the first attempt at Maidan. And the first thing that happened is everything was stripped and sent off to pay debt, but that didn't even make a dent in it. That's why Eastern Ukraine was so important. That's why Eastern Ukraine rose up in revolt, in a counter-revolutionary revolt, and won. That, in turn, is what caused the U.S. to build its military forces in the area, despite the fact that it was completely irrational, that that's where that money should go, and ultimately why Putin was forced to invade. So, I've read the IMF papers on all of this, and this is what Ukraine has to do to become part of the EU, which, Ukraine has exactly zero of the marks legally that pertain to joining the EU. I mean, they're the total opposite of what the EU bylaws say. But the same was the case in Bulgaria, and even that was brought into the EU. So again, rules are suspended, treaties are suspended solely for the sake of these totally politicized and at least temporarily money-losing enterprises. Capitalism today is so obsessed with Russia that they're going to lose a lot of money just in order to harm its one of its central competitors. And today, that's what war is. War is just economic competition by other means.
Well, you just mentioned the IMF there. They are involved in this as well. On his trip to Washington, Naftogaz CEO Chernyshov also met with representatives from the International Monetary Fund, the US-dominated financial institution that is infamous for imposing neoliberal economic policies on indebted nations. This March, the IMF made the unprecedented decision of approving a $15.6 billion loan for Ukraine. The IMF had never before provided financing to a country that is at war. A reporter at US state media outlet NPR admitted that the IMF had to implement a rule change, which was obviously, politically motivated. Naftogaz declared in a press release that successful and consistent cooperation with the IMF is crucial for Ukraine's resilience during the war. Using racist or anti-Russian rhetoric that implied Russia is uncivilized, Chernyshov stated, "Cooperation with the IMF is crucial for the stability of our country in times of war. The fact that we have a program is a signal to the civilized world that the country is moving in the right direction. Ukraine has made its civilizational choice. Naftogaz has fulfilled its part of the conditions for our country to receive the IMF program. This demonstrates that we are a reliable partner. Naftogaz will not let the country down." The Naftogaz statement did not clarify what these conditions were, but a February press release from the IMF made it clear that it includes neoliberal reforms. The IMF reported that its discussions with Ukrainian authorities covered the medium-term macroeconomic framework, fiscal policy, the financing mix, financial sector policies, and governance. The IMF's conditions included, in particular, reform initiatives to enhance productivity and competitiveness of the private sector need to be advanced to help lay the foundations for a robust post-war growth against a backdrop of progress towards EU accession. Reforms to enhance productivity and competitiveness of the private sector is a euphemistic way of saying that Ukraine must further privatize state-owned industries and sell off public assets. In its statement, the IMF stressed, the private sector is also expected to contribute to the reconstruction efforts. The fund also wrote favorably of draft tax laws aimed to increase revenues, calling for shoring up tax revenues and creating fiscal space for war-related repairs. Efforts to expand issuance in the domestic bond market should continue to help ensure a stable financing mix and eliminate reliance on monetary financing, it added. In short, the IMF's conditions for Ukraine are a typical reflection of the Washington consensus. Neoliberal austerity measures, which increase the burden on Ukrainian workers, whose living standards are declining, and who have fewer and fewer rights, while US corporations are offered profitable opportunities to buy up public assets. Now, all of that sort of relies on Ukraine winning, doesn't it? And then all these American companies coming in to rebuild. What if Russia wins and brings in Russian and Chinese companies to rebuild, though? Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this today?
Well, that's exactly the point, and that's what's going to happen. I'm not sure if the IMF is assuming that Ukraine will be able to retake its territory, which, of course, it never can, or even that it could retake Crimea. One of the reasons that the regime is pushing this is to be able to strip these areas that they wanted to do years ago. And, of course, that's not going to happen. And whatever peace terms might be, the Russians, having been the victor, are going to have a huge impact on it. So Ukraine's going to be left with this deindustrialized rump state in the west and the central areas with very little in terms of assets. I've been through the IMF papers in this respect, and everything we talked about in terms of stripping labor of any rights whatsoever has been demanded not just now, but years ago, long before the war. So the war is going to be used to revolutionize what's left of Ukraine with its best men gone, I should note. Its second best men now abroad working because no one, you know, they're, you know, even white collar professionals haven't been paid in months. It's like Russia in the mid-90s. They're being paid in kind in some cases. And the ultimate goal is to create a totally dependent, deindustrialized Ukraine that exports only sex slaves and highly educated, motivated workers. And even then, only a fraction of the debt is going to be paid. But as far as the West is concerned, politically speaking, it's a worthwhile investment. All this money is never going to be seen again.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.